Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to HJT Design Radio Straight Talk, a show dedicated to exploring all aspects. Welcome to HJT Design Radio Straight Talk. A show dedicated to exploring all aspects of creating a great dental office, where the only dumb question is the question that's not asked. Here's Jim and Han.
Good evening. Jim Jarvis here, and sorry for that hiccup. Not quite sure why the system decided to stop and start the intro, but good evening, Han. Are you there?
I am. Good evening, everyone.
Excellent. Well, tonight's episode is a very exciting episode where we're going to have an opportunity to hear from our other co-founder, Dr. Bill Hunsinger. Tonight's episode is number 6, How Many Treatment Rooms Do I Need? One of the primest questions we get asked when we sit down with our clients. And the question is, you know, how many treatment rooms do you want? How many treatment rooms do you need? To that end, unfortunately, Dr. Hunsinger obviously is practicing and is in wrapping up his last cases for this evening. So we haven't got him connected into the show quite yet. So we'll look forward to that here hopefully shortly. But to that end, we're going to change the format a little bit and start with what we typically deal with at the end of the show, until Bill can join us. So to that end, Han, what is happening lately last week during your review and discussions on Dentaltown? Anything interesting?
It's not so much inside the office, but yeah, there was a discussion today that I thought was it's a very good discussion and question about signage. Okay. We had a particular townie that owned a building, and it faces the road. It's a, you know, it's a tenant retail space, and he's going to use portion of it. The front of the building, unfortunately, faces the parking lot, and so the side of the building is the most prominent side of face that they face the main street. It's a very high traffic area, and the discussion was, can he put signage, his signage, on the most prominent face of the building while not being occupied directly on that end of the building? I think it's a legitimate question. If you are the owner of the building, perhaps you can mandate that the most premium signage space is yours. However, if you also occupy the building as a tenant, that may create a little bit of hardship and misunderstanding among other tenants. And because typically, and I do believe this is also mandate also, or have some stipulation based on the zoning code, or zoning ordinance is that the signage of the tenant space is the signage of the for the tenant usually are installed and mounted directly in front over the you know the facade of that front entrance. It's usually not placed somewhere else. It may be shown on your pylon sign or your monument sign, but if you have a signage over your entrance or your space, it usually go directly on the front of the building and not someplace else over another tenant space. Okay, so I thought that was an interesting discussion because it's normally just go over their space, and if you take the most prominent space that belongs that's over somebody else's wall, then they kind of pay for a premium space and don't get to use it, which in my opinion is rather unfair. So that was an interesting topic. One thing before I forget is that besides the signage, I was out and about and I was at a medical facility. Once in a while, the question about flooring material and why it doesn't hold up and stuff like that will come up as a hot topic for discussion. I'm a proponent for green materials and things like that. One of them is rubber flooring, and rubber flooring is often found in a lot of high traffic area, medical facility, you know, your airports and stuff like that. I was in a medical facility in the treatment room, and I was looking at the flooring, which it's rubber. One of the reasons why rubber is used is it's soft on your feet. It's less stress on your skeletal system if you have to walk on it all day long. Secondly, it is quieter. Thirdly, you can chemically seal the seam, so it's become a monolithic sheet of flooring. And it's pretty resilient. It's usually bounced back. The biggest question that often, or the biggest thing that affects the quality and the performance of the flooring is the type of caster use. So, you know, when you put on the floor, you have carpet, you naturally look at the caster made for carpet flooring. If you have a resilient flooring, you know, a vinyl or things like that, then you get a get caster for that tile floor and so on. So it reduces the chance of your flooring get abused or get destroyed. In this case, the rubber flooring has a lot of deep divots in it, and it almost looks like it's melted and it get kind of pushed aside. Think of a puddle of hot wax, and you stick your finger in it, and it kind of ooze out on the side. And that's what is throughout this the floor. And I thought it was interesting, and I look at it and say, what is the cause of that? Is the chair. The chair is not caster. It's a type of chair that has, it's almost like a peg. So you have four pegs. But I'm going to think of high heel, okay? It didn't have a flat disc on the bottom to distribute the weight. It actually have like a peg. Almost like, so this chair have four high heel spikes, and it affects, it damages the floor. I thought it was just, it's some of the things that if you own a building and you're involved in selecting, buying furniture, the selection of the type of legs and the base of the leg matters. It's another detail that you need to pay attention to. So that's the two items that I thought, it's an easy an oversight, pretty easy with furniture. Okay.
Interesting. Well, back to your little discussion about the signage. I've run into that example and situation on numerous facilities, specifically ones that are in more of a an urban environment where,
mm-hmm.
for example, you have lots of buildings crammed into a particular area, and maybe they are facing inwards to a parking, common parking area, but the maximum exposure to maybe a major traffic pattern is on the back of the building. So what you end up having is, you see it a lot with, a prime example is prime outlets. When you drive down the interstate or the turnpike, you've got all these outlet malls that are set off to the side when they all face inward, but the backs of them are where the major signage is. And so you run into that kind of situation where, yes, you need to have signage maybe over your front door, but just as importantly, you need to have signage accessible to a major traffic pattern so that as people drive by, they know where you're located. Because even putting up a pylon sign, you would get lost in that pylon sign because you might be in an environment or a center that has, you know, 20 or 30 different occupants. So, you know, you get your little sign that's maybe 2 feet by 3 feet, and that's all you get. So
you're lucky.
There's that to be concerned about. Then there's also the issue of every local municipality is going to mandate your signage requirement. Some municipalities allow for numerous signs on numerous building walls. Other municipalities only allow for one sign on one wall, and others will only allow for a monument. We've had situations where we've had monument signs that only could advertise the center that you're in and would not allow for the individual tenants to be placed on that monument sign. So the first thing you do, check with the zoning ordinance having to do with your specific location. Be careful that you're not in a PUD, which is called a planned unit development, because they have extra requirements over and above the normal requirements for zoning. So it's complicated, and also you're best to get a professional to look at it if you're trying to accomplish something like what Han was discussing with regards to having multiple signs and also the ability to be able to place those signs on different walls. And lastly, of course, is the lease. Yes, Han?
Yes, Jim. The PUD, that does that usually apply to like commercial or industrial parks?
No. A PUD could be anything. You could have a PUD in a residential environment. You can have a PUD in a mixed use environment. PUD stands for planned unit development, which means a specific area has been developed. And we have Bill. Hold on a second, Han. I'm going to get Bill on.
Okay.
Bill, are you there?
Yeah, hi, Jim. Sorry I'm late checking in with you tonight.
Not a problem. Han and I were discussing the issues of what were happening on latest on Dentaltown. So now that we've got you, we're going to start our main discussion today, which is obviously today's episode is how many treatment rooms do I need? The age-old question, how do you figure out what's the best way to do it? How should I determine what I can fit within my office? And all the other fun particulars. So to start this, Han, I'd like to ask the question, because you and Bill obviously have the most experience in dealing with this. Let's say I have a 3,000 square foot facility, and it's an existing facility. Maybe it's a retail center, and I want to determine how many operatories. How would I do that, Han?
Well, if you have a 3,000 square foot space, okay, regardless of the size, just hypothetically, the rectangle is about 3,000 square feet. We typically look at and use a design ratio between 350 to 400 square feet per operatory. So a quick division that will give you between 7 to 8. If we use, let's say, 400 square feet per square foot, 400 square foot per operatory, that would yield you about 7 to 8 operatory for that space. Naturally, we can get more, but typically 7 to 8 will give you a very comfortable, a comfortable number. And enough elbow room to do everything that you need to do within that space.
And that's also determined by all the other stuff that the dentist wants to put within his building. There could be things that are going to take more square footage or less square footage. But it's a good rule of thumb.
It takes into consideration that you have all of the support areas, you know, your typical sterilization lab, the number of toilet rooms, sufficient waiting area to accommodate the number of patients that's going to in the chair as well as waiting, staff areas and all the support area that's within that to allow you to have an efficient and well-equipped, well-run office.
Well, Bill, I'm going to throw this next question at you. If I'm a sole practitioner, how many operatories should I have?
Well, Jim, a lot of it depends on how many patients you have. So one of the things I'd like to go back on and talk a little bit with Han about was some of the information that's out there now that you see a lot of on operatory size. And one of the things that you hear a lot about is the smaller size operatories. Now, I've been in practice many years, and as you guys know, you've designed all of my offices, as a matter of fact. And my operatories are larger, I would say, by today's standard. Han, what are you finding on the small side? What are you getting feedback from doctors as far as operatory size?
Yeah, there's a movement in the dental community pushing to have treatment room without cabinets, without side cabinets. It can go down to as tight as 8 feet wide and about 10 feet deep. So that is the typical that I have seen discussed. We normally, if a client come to us and say, this is what I'm looking for, we would, you know, a few of the questions that we ask them is how have they practiced in a space that big. If not, then we recommend that they at least go and find a space within their home or someplace where they can chalk out an outline of a operatory that are 8 wide, 10 deep, put a lazy boy in there and a couple chair and pack 3 bodies in there and stay in there for a while. Now, whatever the duration of a treatment plan is, I kind of jokingly say, why don't you, grab your hair and scream and run out, it's not for you, okay? I personally have witnessed people that has a claustrophobic attack, and it's not cute. Before you commit yourself to an operatory that are 8 wide and 10 deep, try that out. But we normally try to do, if 8 is all they want, then 8 we go, but we try to give them a little more depth up to 11 feet, so that way they can, move along at the toe back and forth without problems. And if you happen to have, like, a 6 foot or a plus in the chair, then they're not, they don't rest their feet on the wall. So build a typically the smallest that we have designed for a treatment room is 8 wide and roughly 11, give or take, in depth.
Right, and I would agree with that. And I've actually worked in both environments. I've worked in a small operatory, probably just over 8 feet wide, and maybe just over 10 feet long. And it does work. I will tell you, it does work. There was one. We had a side desk cabinet. We had one sink. And we worked off of a tray and tub system, which means everything is centrally located. You can bring it into the operatory very easily and work. A lot depends on the type of delivery system. We were always rear delivery, although it's fairly easy to take a room that size and drop a all-in-one chair into that space with a light attached to it and work. We use those as hygiene rooms. So I worked in a small space The challenge with a small space is it is a small space. And any more, what you're finding is patients have companions with them that they actually want to sit in the operatory, believe it or not, and visit. It depends on your style of practice. But I'm going to tell you right now that if you're on a tight budget, you've got a practice that you're starting up and you're looking to reduce square foot, then you need to talk to us because we have a lot of experience having worked in it, designed hundreds of operatories of all different sizes and laid them out from all different sizes. So if you're on a tight budget, as we know, boys, construction costs are going up or down these days.
No, they're going up.
They're
going
always
up. And availability of builders is going down. Everybody's busy.
So now it can be a tight budget, but you've also got to look out to how long you're going to be in that space and how long you're going to practice. Now, my small space was absolutely based on the fact that I had no money and no patients. So that was definitely challenging. And we had a five-operatory space that we dropped three chairs in, and we minimized the cost, and we really got the thing going. As you guys know, we were able to work in that space for a while. But when we designed our new spaces, what did we do? Well, the operatories, what are operatories now? Probably 10.5 by 11 or 12, something like that, would you guys say? So what we found with that is that we like having a work area on one side of the operatory. We still use trays and tubs. Now that we've seen the newer designs, would we put cabinetry on both sides? Probably not. And actually, we're adding two operatories to our office space now, and we're not doing that. We're going to be using a mobile cart type system. So the other thing that we're finding is all the technology that's out there now is room to bring your CEREC machine. You have to have room to bring in your laser. Sometimes we have Soleil CO2 lasers in our offices. We have CEREC Omnicams in our offices. We have a Trio system in our offices. And you need to have some space in the operatory. We also use pulse oximeter. So we're going toward a larger operatory, which actually is more efficient. Now, I was just in. I will answer your question, Jim. I'm not a politician. I will get to the answer your question you specifically asked me for.
I haven't forgotten.
I'm digressing. I know, I'm digressing. I know you're sitting there thinking, why does he answer the question? Because you guys just got me all involved in the first question, so the yes con. So what you've got to do is think about how you're going to do this. Now, I got to tell you, I was just at a large dental meeting in Orlando, Florida, called Sirona World, which some of our listeners may have been at or have heard about, and it's a very, very large technology based meeting. And at that meeting, I actually looked at some new designs of operatories that were there. And I mean, this is so new, I don't think you and I have discussed it yet, but they're much larger. The operatories are, gosh darn, Han, they must have been 10 by 12 or 12 by 12, which is quite large. And what they're doing is this company, and it is Sirona, by the way, has a delivery system, which is an all-in-one, drop in the room, has about everything in it. And it's fascinating from the standpoint that it does have everything in it. They only sell two systems. It's either right-handed or it's one that you can flip back and forth between right and left. Now, I have dealt with left-handed doctors, so that's why we've always used a system where it can be flipped back and forth, which in our case is a dual-function rear delivery cart. Todd, you know that you and I both have looked at chairs that you can flip the delivery system from side to side, and these units tend to be that way, and they are big and they are expensive. And they've also gravitated toward a single entry.
Han, we lost Bill. So we'll have to wait for him to call back in. That's the advantage and disadvantage of having two facilities, one remote from the other, and he was driving back from his Swanton location through to the and I'm sure he hit the cell tower issue. But here we go. He's back on.
Yeah.
Okay, Bill, gotcha.
Hey, welcome to Fulton County, Ohio.
So, I just was saying that.
Yeah, we were, you know, as you know, I practice in a small town of about 33,000 people, 18 miles west of Sylvania, Toledo. So that's where our 12 operatory office is, by the way, and 6,500 active patients. So anyway, it's a fascinating system. As I was looking at it, I was impressed by what it was. I was also scared to death of what happens if something doesn't work in that chair, in that system. I was a little concerned about breakdowns because everything's all together. I mean, it either works great or you may have challenges. But it's a totally fascinating way to design offices. And like I said, there are many ways to skin this cat. You can, but if you need to shrink it down, we are absolute experts on how to do that. And we've got doctors that have worked, especially I've worked in about every situation, that can give you some advice about it. Would I do it again? On my budget where I didn't have any money, yes. But if I had a practice going where I had enough active patients to get it started, I would definitely build the operatory bigger. A lot of the docs are building the operatories bigger now. Most of the guys I talked to, most of the people I talked to did not tend to gravitate toward the smaller operatory. So just because of the way people are now.
What would be a number of active patients, Bill?
Okay, so this is how I started to figure it out. Let's get back. So you're actually going to make me answer the question. So one of the things that you have to decide is if you're in a space right now that feels too small. One of the first things I want to know is how many operatories you do have. So you and I, and Don and you, the three of us have discussed in many times if we were going to start with a practice, because I actually bought a practice at one point that I had four operatories at the most, and it was in fact I'm dealing with a client of ours who's in four operatories right now, and the challenge that he's having with four operatories is he has about 1,300 active patients, and he's working about 32 hours a week, which I believe comes out to just over 50, and he's taken 4 weeks off, so I think he's about 1,500 hours a year. And if you run an hour appointments, you've got about 3,000 hygiene appointments available, and then what you do is you break that back down to how many hygiene appointments you need. And so when you crunch all those numbers, and then you have to look at how long is your hygiene visit. Is it a 60-minute visit or is it a 50-minute visit? So one of the challenges he's having is they're doing more comprehensive treatment, so they need a little more time for the hygienist to review treatment and go over, take photographs and x-rays and discuss the needs of the patient. So they're running 60-minute appointments. And the challenge is he's fairly busy, and they're running four operatories, so they've got a hygienist in operatory three and a hygienist in operatory four, and he's working out of one and two. And as you know, there are emergencies that come in. So when you have operatory one scheduled with your high production, operatory two scheduled with seating crowns and doing some restorations and checking emergencies, those two rooms can get blocked up. And then what happens is, if you're not running on time, then you get stuck where the hygienist can't turn a room over. And there are only a few things we have to do to turn over rooms now between patients. And that takes time. So at four ops, you just can't make it work. So you have to go to a minimum of five. If you're going to work that many hours per year, then you're going to need at least five operatories, and should be able to treat up to about 2,300 active patients in a five operatory office working about 1,500 hours a year. So what happens when you get to that point where you're too busy at 5, which we actually have another client who's too busy at 5 right now, and his challenge is he has over 3,800 active patients, and so he's trying to figure out, what the heck do I do? So my first suggestion to him was to go to a more of a split shift schedule, and when we sat down and calculated how many hours he's going to work and how many hours the associate's going to work, it already was at his 3,800 active patients. So he's actually already past the point of no return with his 5 operatories, and he's going to have a real challenge attempting to work a split shift. Now, what the heck do I mean by a split shift?
Yeah, that was going to be my next question.
Yeah, I figured you were going to ask me that one. So split shift, what you tend to do is if you're a productive doctor, which I find many of our docs that have been in practice anywhere from 5 to 10 or 15 years or more are pretty much kind of figured out on how to efficiently treat people in a timely manner, in a productive manner. You can set your office up where you're working about 26 hours a week, and you bring your associate in, and he's working 26 hours a week. And I got to tell you, we did this ourselves. I found a great associate who's now my partner, and that my friends is challenging, but he is just a perfect partner. He did a great, just a fantastic guy, and we worked our 26 hours a week, and we were both taking 4 weeks off. And Howard Fran taught me this probably 25 years ago, at least, maybe longer. He's got a book called The Business of Dentistry, which has been around forever, which I would recommend people look at. And so we were open Monday 8 to 5, Tuesday 8 to 8, Wednesday 8 to 8, Thursday 8 to 8, Friday 8 to 5, and Saturdays 8 to 1. And we were able to easily treat up to about that 3,500 to 38, and it got, because we were running 50-minute appointments, and it got to be challenging. Now, why do I like 5 ops? I like 5 ops because I like having that extra room. You have 2 schedule rooms. You got your hygienist in each room. We actually use a hygiene coordinator when we're running like this to help the hygienist tear the room down as they're dismissing the patient. And it worked very, very, very well. But when we hit that point, then you have to make another decision. So the next, so what I'm saying, we're about at 2,300 if you're by yourself and you've got five operatories minimum is what I would say. You can build an office. I think our office at that site was it 2,200, Jim, I think? I think we had half of a medical arts building. I think we were about 2,200 square feet. And it was
that sounds
tight.
About
now,
right. Yeah.
How tight was it? Well, how tight was it? Let's talk about how tight it was. The lab was a closet, okay? The Panorex was at the end of the hallway next to that closet. There was a small room for supplies. There was no place for the staff to sit down and take a lunch break. We had to actually lock the reception area door so we could eat lunch. We had a very small consultation room, which is also a file room. The office manager's room was the 2 doctor's offices, too. That was, oh, gosh, it had to be no more than 6 by 7. It was a tight spot. We had one check-in position, one check-out position. So it was very, very tight. It was a challenge, but it worked. So I know how to make that work. So if you need a small space, I know how to make that work, okay? But you're not going to be sitting on your computer all day and checking your social media. You're going to be working. So, but when we went to the split shift, we were able to. Now, I got to tell you, we never practiced together. We would meet together, but we'd never practice together. So, you have to stay in communication with somebody when you're working a split shift because you just don't cross over. So I don't recommend necessarily hiring somebody you need to mentor to come into that situation. Now, if you guys love each other, we have another practice that we work with out of town where these guys all want to practice together. So they work 8 to 5. They're 5 days a week, and they have this big 12 operatory office where they're all three of them are there together, which is fine, okay, but it doesn't really give people more options as far as consumer-friendly hours. And that was one of the things that we wanted and which has been very successful for us is being able to be open three nights a week and go from there. So far, Saturday. Yeah, and you were open the weekend. So what happens is that you can stay tight and trim and efficient at five operatories, and just you've got to have systems. You got to be working at a pretty good pace, but you can make it work. Now, if I was going to do it again, I actually like six operatories better because I like having three for myself because I love to have emergencies come in with broken teeth that I can fix and help them and still see my regularly scheduled patients in an effective manner. And I also like having that extra hygiene operatory in case. I got to tell you, most of that hygiene running behind is a doctor issue. It's just that we're not moving along and checking hygiene in an efficient manner. Or what also is nice now is that our hygienists are actually able to do sealants and provide bleaching and other services in a chair if they know they've got an extra chair and they've got a hygiene coordinator to help them out. So I guess so far we're at like a 2,300, and then we got the 35 to 3,800. And then beyond that, let's say that you want to practice together, just so we have that calculation. So if you're going to practice together and you're both going to work about 32 hours a week, which is 4 days a week, is which most guys like to do, is not work more than 4 days a week. You can imagine you're going to have to build about a 10 operatory office to make it work. And if you're going to really go like the way I do, you want to build 12. So even this 10 to 12 operatory office that's not open enough hours, quite honestly. So I don't necessarily recommend that, but if you have six, you can bring an associate in. It's a tight space. If you want to go slower with an associate, you have to mentor. I think you need to think in terms of maybe having eight operatories, because if you're going to practice together, you should have at least two operatories. You know, the associate's probably not going to be able to do more than one chair. I've got a doctor that produces actually a high level, a lot of dentistry, who works one chair, who's just told me that he's decided to slow down. He's 73 years old, and I put him against every young associate in every practice that you guys and I have consulted in, and he beats every one of those guys. Because he knows what he's doing. That's one of the key things. But if you're going to mentor somebody and you're going to practice together, you have to have a bigger space. So two operatories for you, one for emergencies. You've got four hygienists. You're going to start out with at least three because you want to keep your two hygienists as busy as you can. When you bring in your associate, your challenge, if you're bringing in an associate, here's what you got to be looking at, is am I not getting my hygiene patients in a timely manner? And when can a new patient get in? If a new patient can't get in a timely manner, which is that week for sure, or sooner, and your people are calling in your office and they can't get into your hygiene schedule for 2 or 3 weeks, then you've got issues. So you either need to go split shift, or if you're going to bring an associate in and work together, you have to have a much bigger space. So, again, let's review, because I'm a dentist, and I know dentists are trying to write this down, and we're slow. So two operatories for you plus an emergency, two operatories for your hygienist, that's five. And if the other new doctor's going to come in, you're going to get them up running and gunning or whoever that person is, and they're going to be doing the same thing to you, so that's five. So you've got 10 right there. To equip with the new doctor, they have to have at least one. You have to have at least two more equipped, so you're at least at seven. So anywhere from 8 to 10, it does not make sense in my mind. If you're going to practice together with two doctors, you really need to think of it in terms of 10 ops if you're really going to make the practice go. Now, at 10 ops, what you can do is then you can actually, if you get another challenge where you haven't got enough space, then you can start think about split shifting, and then you can well, lightning. We have a little storm here in Toledo. So you can actually go to a split shift, and you can treat more active patients. And what do I mean by active patients? Active patients is anybody that's been in for an exam in your office in the last 18 months. Your hygiene effectiveness, which is how many of them are you getting in a timely manner, you should be, okay, I'm a real-life practicing wet fingers dentist. I got to tell you, we work extremely hard at getting paid. I've got every kind of contact and every kind of text message and postcards, believe it or not, and calls and emails and pre-scheduling and every kind of thing you could possibly imagine. And we probably get 70 to 75% of our active patients in a fairly regular basis. So, I think a great goal is 60 to 70%, but don't tell any of the consultants that you heard that from me, because they all want 80 or more. So, and I'm still wondering how they do it. So anyway, if you're not getting them in a timely manner, then you got to decide what you're going to do. So you could take your tenop office and do split shifts in it, and decide how many hours you're going to work. You can really, if you know what you're doing, you can practice about 1,200 hours a year and do pretty well with a good staff. And split shifting a 10-off office, you should be able to get to 5,000 to maybe 5,500 active patients and operate. Now, we are at over 6,500 active patients right now on 50-minute hygiene schedules. And we're seeing anywhere from 50 to 100 new patients a month. And we're not a big PPO practice. And but we're at a point now we have to build two more operatories and go to 14. So this is a lot of information all at once. I have this actually all written out in a form that's actually legible because I had somebody type it. I'd be more than happy to send it along to somebody or speak to anybody who's interested in knowing the numbers and figuring out how they work. But there's a lot of good practice management people who will tell you need to figure out how much you want to make, how many hours you're going to week, and how much you have to produce per hour, and where your hygiene department is. But in my mind, your hygiene department drives your practice. A lot of your restorative work comes out of your hygiene practice. So if you're not getting your hygiene patients in, you're messing up. I'm just telling you right now. You're not doing things correctly. You need to rethink how your office operates. And you've got to take great care of those people because they pay all your bills. Our hygiene department is highly successful. They probably do at least a third to 40% of what we're doing, which is nice because what's nice when hygiene is operating at a high level, that means the doctor's not in there having to produce it himself. And like I said, hygiene drives the practice. So did I answer the question or is it too much information?
Actually, you answered,
Bill.
Yeah, you answered the question plus my next three. But the one you didn't answer is having to do with, you touched on it, having to do with, you know, hygiene creates your business and drives your practice, and then your operatories based upon how much you want to make. What's the rule of thumb of what an operatory should produce in a dollars and cents in a successful practice?
I forgot you were going to ask me that. And of course, you know, I'm driving in my car and I can't look it up. So, oh gosh, Jim, what was it? You and I were just talking about this when we were in Chicago, I think.
When we were in Chicago, you used a number of $25,000 to $30,000 per up.
Okay. So let me see if that is actually true. That's per month, right? Oh yeah, that is absolutely correct. Because yes, it should be $25,000 to $30,000 per month per operatory. That is absolutely correct. Okay, and I have to tell you, that up until recently in our 12 operatory office, we used to have a few empty seats we could put people in. So, and just to give you an idea, we're working split shifts every day, practically. And I didn't make the calculation how many hours a year we're open tonight. But yes, you're right, Jim. So that's actually a great number.
Han, you had a comment.
Bill, is that number $25,000 to $30,000 per operatory per month? Is that considered the average, or is that on the productive side?
Well, that's pretty productive, huh? That's a doctor running two operatories that are really rocking and rolling, and having a third operatory that's available to do extra treatment, and a hygiene schedule that's pretty full.
So if you have a doctor,
I've got a couple guys that we're working with right now that are working with people that are extremely slow, and they're lucky to do probably 10,000, which is kind of sad, you know, or 15,000. So it's pretty sad. So again, you know, when you're thinking about this, you need to look at yourself first. What are you doing? Is your office productive? Is it ramped up? Is it ready to go? Okay. So, and I know, and you guys are well aware of it, when we were designing our 12 operatory office, which we kind of actually thought might be too big already, we had that active patient base going, and we had a team put together in the smaller space that we could easily move to the bigger space and grow the practice. Now, the other challenge you'll have, which is a good challenge, is that usually a new office will get an immediate bump in new patients and production. So you've got to be prepared for that too. But I've got to tell you, you just can't, you know, hope that that's going to continue unless you have efficient systems and you're available to people and you're nice and everything else works properly. But to me, it doesn't make any sense. And I we've dealt with clients that they don't have very many active patients. You know, they barely have 1,500 active patients. And they're trying to design this big space, and they don't have the team ramped up to make it work. And so if anybody's out there who's not getting close or thinking about the numbers, which we've discussed, which, again, we can send to you if you email us or contact us. There's Han and Jim know how to contact us. You go through the website. But we can send you these numbers and give you an idea of what you're looking at, and see how big of a space. But Han, you know, when you were talking about square footage of offices, now I know there's a recent one that you and I were discussing. That is it 12 ops, or is it in Pennsylvania, right? Is it 12?
Yes, 12.
And how big is that one?
It's a pediatric office. It's a 6,000 square foot space. But her 6,000 square foot space. Bill?
So that's a big one.
Yeah. That's 500 square foot per.
But she has a lot of area that are not typically fine. You know, in the dentist's office. So if your amenities may include extra storage space, and you want your room to be wider, because, you know, like for instance, one of the questions that I asked of the, you know, of those that have done the 8x11 foot operatories, is that do they allow a patient to go, you know, the companion to go back in the room with them? And none have ever gave me a direct answer, and it's very simple. The answer is no, because you don't have the room. You have the room for the clinical side, but when you put a 8 foot wide operatory and you put the chair in there, the companion will be literally on the lap of the patient in the chair. You just don't have the room in there. Okay, so it depends on what you do in your practice and how you practice, and whether you allow patient to have companion back, and then you need to consider a wider space for the operatory. So I'm actually I'm going to do a research after the next day or two about this Rona new design of the 12x12 treatment room. I'm just curious what is it that they do or can do.
It's interesting. It's definitely for a specific client. It's definitely somebody who, like, it's a lot of bells and whistles. It's got a lot of stuff on it, but it's got a big footprint. So, yeah, you'll be fascinated by it, I'm sure. Yeah, Han loves that kind of stuff. He likes to see footprints and connections and how all the little things connect. And then he just loves that stuff. So I looked at it and said, it's too big and too expensive. That was the first thing I thought.
I think you're about 99%.
Wasn't it in Chicago, Dr. Tommy Murph said, you know, he likes his operatories at 12 by 15?
Huge.
Oh, yeah. He likes big operatories, which, you know what, that's what's great. I'm going to tell you, that's what's great about dentistry. Let's just face it. If you've got the financial resources, you can pretty much build the space you want and make it work. But in my mind, there has to be a purpose to that space. I mean, we've got big offices. I mean, I didn't think our Swanton office was as big as it was. What'd you guys tell me? 5,000 or some?
5,600.
Ungodly.
Yeah.
5,400 in Swanton. Okay. 5,400 in Swanton. The closets are too small. And then we redesigned it in Sylvania, and it's 6,000 and change.
Yeah, about 1,000 square feet, more bigger.
Yeah. So if you build – now, what did we do in that office? Well, we've created a space that patients really love. We've created a space that staff loves. I mean, I've got I regularly meet with staff before at the beginning of every day, and I have a table big enough that two doctors can sit down with five to six assistants, a couple of hygiene coordinators, and four hygienists, and a treatment coordinator, a front desk person, and discuss every person that's coming into that office that day and what's needed and what treatment has not been taken care of yet that's been diagnosed. So, and we have an X-ray system. We have a monitor and X-rays and everything there so we can review it. And that room is big. And in that room, of course, there's a refrigerator, and they can eat lunch there, and they can check the schedule. And then we decided that we were going to have a locker room area to where we keep all the scrubs. We keep scrubs so people change from their street clothes into their scrubs in the office. And I just think that keeps everything cleaner. If you're not going home in your scrubs or your clinic coat and you're leaving everything in the office. Plus, I get to walk around incognito if I decide. I can wear my T-shirt, my shorts, and nobody really knows I'm supposed to be a hotshot dentist. So that I like. And so, you know, we have that kind of space available. Now, I'm going to tell you right now that Han will also tell you with all the HIPAA stuff, you've got to design your front desk in a certain way, your reception area. We don't have waiting rooms, guys. We have reception areas. And what's interesting is that space, you may have to be a little bigger than you think, because what happens is people bring people with them to the dentist. And you know, what's nice about a nice space is that they bring their friends. Your friends come in, they're not going to be patients of yours, and they hang out in your reception area thinking, you know, this is a pretty nice place. And the next thing you know, they're going, are you taking any new patients? So I'm really kind of against that little cramped area where the dead fish are in the aquarium. I like to have a little more room. I like to have enough chairs. Han loves to make this calculation on how much space you need, how many chairs you need based on how many operatories you have. And he likes to do the thing where if you're building a parking lot, because I got to tell you right now, everybody in the Midwest likes to pull up to your front door and park in free parking. That's the way it is in Toledo. It is in Swanton. So he makes all those calculations. He knows how many handicap spaces you should have. And Han just loves to decide on all that. And we have a lot of kids in our practice, so we have a little separate area where we try to put them over to the side where mom can keep an eye on them, or dad and grandma, whoever brings them. But they can kind of make some noise and not disturb everybody else who's in the office. And I believe in a consultation room. But we do treatment plans knee to knee right next to the patient. I learned that from Howard Ferrand, and it works very well. But it's really kind of cool to sit down with a monitor in front of you that's larger and walk through a case with a patient who's going to spend $30,000, $40,000, $50,000, $60,000 with you in a private setting that's a little more professional. My office, we have an office space. I don't really believe in a big fancy office space, as you guys know. We actually have four desks in a room. The only thing that they let me have is they let me have my own bathroom. So we have a bathroom. There's anywhere from 2 to 4 of us in there at any given time. And what's nice about us all being together, we discuss cases, which is absolutely cool. I have to tell you, that's a cool thing about being in a practice like ours, that I got a bunch of really smart people that I work with and I learn from them because we can talk. And and we talk during the crossovers, and we talk during a meeting we have regularly on a biweekly basis, and it works very well. So anyway, it's exciting. My gosh, it's already 9:00, and we haven't really talked about everything. I've been talking too much.
No, we've got a few more minutes. Let me ask this one question, Bill. If I'm a dentist, I've been in practice maybe 5 years. What do I need to come to you with in regards to what information do you need to help me determine what I do next? Active patients is one. What else?
Yeah, active patients. I want to know how many adult hygiene visits you do in the last 6 months. I want to know how many child hygiene visits you have in the last 6 months. I want to know how many 4910, which is a hygiene perio maintenance appointments you had. And then what I'll do is I'll sit down and we can calculate how many patients you're actually seeing on a monthly basis. We'll look at your active patient base and decide, you're like at 40% effectiveness. You stink. Is it because you don't have enough operatories and enough appointments available? And what are we going to do about it? We can also look at your hourly hygiene production. And I got to tell you, every practice I've walked into, we've been able to increase the hygiene productivity by just doing a few things. And what's nice about hygiene productivity, it helps you pay for your new space if you need it. So we need active patients. We need the number of hygiene visits that you're actually seeing and how many you have available, so we can come up with a percentage and see what's going on. Again, if you don't have and we got to know about how many new patients you're getting in a month. So based on that, we can calculate about how many appointments you're going to need for your soft tissue management program. So that's a pretty easy couple of numbers to come up with. And then and then we look at the associate's productivity too, if you have an associate. And what I find a lot of times is that the doctor, the owner doctor, is producing at a much higher level than the associate. And unfortunately, in a smaller office, the associate's taking up space that's killing the productivity of the doctor. So we discuss that sometimes too. But those are basic things you need, the numbers we just need to have to take a look at. And it's pretty easy to come up with a plan to get your new place going. So
that could be a renovation of your existing, or that could be a new facility. All of this is germane to both of those. It's not predicated on.
Oh yeah, it'll work. I mean, we've got redesigns. We've got guys that have leasehold spaces they're expanding into. We have guys coming building stuff out of the ground. It's just a matter of what does the business look like? What do you want to do with it? Where you're going with it? And then figuring out, can I make it work here? Do I have to move? Where do I have to move? And we've got a whole massive information about what to look for. We're working with a company right now that does an excellent job at demographics, calculating where a good spot would be a dentist, where you could maybe put your dental office. It's an exciting time to be a dentist. The economy's on the move. Patients are getting dentistry done. It's a competitive market, so you really want to know what you're doing. You want to have a nice facility. You want to make the experience nice. I got to tell you, one of the things we haven't brought up tonight, and let's just talk about it real quickly because it's 9 o'clock right now, is, guys, we were at Dentaltown, a couple years ago, and I thought Howard Foran made a very profound statement. And what he was talking about was what percent of overhead is your physical building. And what he did is, I think, what did he say, 8 to 9%? I know that number's here somewhere. And what did he say the other large component of your office expense is? I believe it was labor.
It did, yes.
Yes, yes.
And I believe, Han and Jim, what did he say? He says everybody wants to build a small office with what? Not enough operatories, correct?
Right.
Correct.
And so what happens if you don't have enough operatories and you've got all this high-priced talent doing what?
Nothing.
Sitting around.
Standing around waiting for an operatory to open. So our basic device, our idea is you got to know what you've got and you got to know where you're going. And I got to tell you, we've got that figured out. I mean, like I said, we can make pretty good projections. And based on that, we can give you a good idea of how many operatories that you want to build. And you can build them small, and you can build them medium, and you can build them big, and you can do all kinds of different things. And there are fundamentals that you need to have in your office. And I got to tell you, I never, ever wanted to reinvent the wheel. So what I always did, and I would advise people to do the same thing, is to find somebody who's successful and got what you want and doing what you want to do and figure out how they did it and copy it, okay? And what you'll find is after about 6 months, after you copy it, somebody will ask you about it, and then all that information becomes yours. So we've got a lot of information. We can solve a lot of issues if you're having them. If you just can't figure it out, then you need to get a hold of us, and we can really get you set on the right path. And these two guys, they don't have me on this show every week because they never get to say anything. So we can provide you with a ton of information on all the other fun stuff. So all the other fun stuff is how to put the rooms in an efficient manner, how to hook all the stuff up, how to make sure it's energy efficient and green, how to make it work. I mean, these guys absolutely know what they're doing, and they're experts, and they've looked at I can't tell you how many designs and talked to a bunch of people, and they're really nice about it, and they're very kind, and they're very understanding, and I tend not to be. So, because when something is done, you definitely want to give contact us. We'll send you the information. Han, we need to have a few comments. So, Han, a lot. We may have to have part two on this sometime. Is there anything you need to add to what we talked about so far?
Yes, actually, you tell them about how many operatories they need and they need and stuff like that. That's great. Well, that's like the starting point, okay? The thing is, you have to also plan for growth. How the heck is it that when you need more operatory that you don't go out and reinvent the wheel, move your location, or bulldoze it and build new? You have to figure that if you're going to, let's say you need 7 op, but you're going to be there for another 10, 15, 20 years, and as you grow, how the heck is it that you're going to expand in that location? The design of that facility need to take that into consideration. There's my 2 cents, Bill.
Yeah, and we've done that. We've done that, and these two guys are brilliant because we did it, and we actually didn't actually know we were going to do it, but we actually had a good idea about it, and it's working. So those guys know how to do that, too. Now, Jim, on the architectural side, and I got to tell you, there's a lot of missing pieces we haven't talked about, but what these guys can do is, like, one of the things that just came up, Jim, was the shape of a building on a lot. You and I just discussed it.
Yeah, that's true. And you've got to be so careful in regards to taking into account what Han just talked about is the ability to expand in the future. You have to plan for that in such a way that there are so many. We talked about it in some of our previous episodes. Go back and listen to the podcast about things like. There we go. Okay. Things like setbacks and all those issues having to do with the shape of the building and how it relates to your existing piece of property or your new piece of property that you're looking to purchase. And actually, Bill, we do have a second episode. We do have a second episode coming up, episode number 10. We're going to talk about how do I use dentistry to pay for the practice. And that's going to be another one of you as a guest host. So we'll have that coming up here in several weeks. Next week's episode is going to be lease space or own your own building. So Han and I are going to have an in-depth discussion about that and all those little fun particulars that have to go around making that particular decision. But obviously,
you guys are awesome at this. I'm going to tell you, you're awesome at this.
Well, I think we create a unique team, which we've talked about in our first episode about you can't really recreate this team anywhere out there with the individual experiences of over 100 years worth of experience right now in this organization. So with that, we're quite glad and happy we had the opportunity to have Bill as part of this show. And we're looking forward to continuing this and adding him as many times as we can actually get him and tie him down because he is a busy guy like we all are. But that's how you're successful, right, Bill?
Oh, yeah, that's the way it works. And like I said, if you need more information about the numbers, I can provide those for you. I know we have a way to contact us. We have a lot of good ways to contact us, and we'd love to visit with you.
Yeah.
I know
the
we're
best way
a consultation at this point.
The best way is to get us through the website, www.hjtdesign.com, and or our phone number, 1-866-213-1268. That's toll-free. Any last
Excellent.
Words, Han?
Excellent.
No, I think we're good. Bill, appreciate you setting the time to spend with us, and we promise you next episode we'll give you more time to talk.
We love doing what we do.
Well, you know what they say.
If you haven't noticed.
We're excited about it, honey. As you know, I can speak up to 50
yes,
words a minute, and I can gust up over 100, so you never know what's going to happen. Okay, well, good night, guys. I'll be catching up with you the next day or so.
Thank you,
thanks,
gentlemen.
Bill.
Thank you all
guys.
For listening.
Bye-bye. Good night, everyone.
You've been listening to HJT Design Radio Straight Talk with Jim and Han. To contact us and find out more info about upcoming shows, please log on to our website at www.hjtdesign.com. Until next time.